Hello, John. Thanks for coming on the podcast today.
Yeah, thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. I'm excited to talk to you today. You know, you're what we might call a modern day shaman, right? Who has been a practicing shaman healer for a number of years. And, you know, there's a lot to get into there in terms of the shamanic journeying, the healing process, the sort of worldview within, you know, your particular shamanic tradition, and everything that sort of goes along there. So I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, me too.
So I'd like to start today with just a little bit about you. You know, how did you sort of get into this world, given that it's not really, you know, part of most of, you know, Western culture?
Totally. And I don't belong to any sort of indigenous group. And so I come from a decidedly European background, Western world background. And it is not a typical thing. And I spent 25 years in technology. So also not a very typical place to wind up. But like a lot of people who are drawn to shamanism, I was drawn as a result of a health crisis that happened to me in my early 40s. And I just turned 50, so that was a while ago. And I was doing everything I could to heal from this crisis. I was seeing doctors. I was taking supplements. I was, taking care of my health, exercising. Meditation was a big part of that. I've been a meditator my whole life. Interestingly, one day while I was meditating, and this has never happened to me before or since, I heard this very loud male voice that sounded like it was coming from outside of my head saying, "You need to go learn shamanism." Hmm. And I had no idea. I didn't know really what shamanism was. I'd heard the word shaman. I've heard shamanism, but didn't know what it entailed. Had no idea. I live in the state of Maine in the US and I don't live in Peru or Mongolia. So how's that going to work? As it turns out, there's a really healthy shamanic community here and some really fantastic teachers. And so I started, I don't know if I begged or bribed my way into an apprenticeship, but I got into an apprenticeship and had no intention of ever working with other people, just working on myself, and have spent a lot of time training, I think all in all about 7 years. Which includes a couple years of teacher training because I teach as well. It became my home, really. Shamanism is really where when you embrace the shamanic path, it sort of becomes a part of you more than something you do. It really is something you are. The training, the practice transforms you. And it's a path that I love. I absolutely love just about everything about it. So.
Hmm. Oh, so what is it about it that, you know, you feel so connected to?
So I'm a little bit of a, I have a little bit of issues with authority. So it is a form of spirituality that has no, there's no hierarchy, there's no authority, there's no holy book, there's no dogma. It's completely practical. Maybe not completely. There are things you can do that are frivolous as well, but its intention is to be very practical. Its intention is to heal or to get information. In indigenous cultures, it might be where and when do we hunt, or when do we plant crops, or any of those things that really help the community at large in the ways that they need help. And so from that respect, it's very practical. Mm-hmm. But I'm a lifelong learner, and the topic of shamanism is so broad, and so you can go very broad and you can go very deep. And so I feel like I will never stop learning about shamanism in my entire life, and I will never exhaust everything there is to know about it. And that's exciting to me. I love that. Mm-hmm.
So what was it about the sort of shamanic tradition that really stood out to you in the sense of how it differs from an ordinary view of the world, let's say?
So So the shamanic tradition really is a path of direct revelation, meaning, you know, anyone who trains in shamanism, anybody who learns how to journey, really, you are getting your own answers for everything. You're becoming more and more self-reliant. So with clients or students, I am never trying to create a dependent relationship. It's not, I tell people up front, I am a guide, not a guru. Like, you don't come to me for answers. You come to me to, like, hey, maybe go look over here. But I'm not going to interpret your omens for you, or I'm not going to interpret your dreams for you. Well, I mean, they do with clients, but with students, yeah. I'm not going to interpret your journeys for you, because you have to, you know, it's sort of like, you know, you got to learn how to walk, but then once you do, I'm going to try to steer you away from danger, but really I'm going to get you to running as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of the sort of like basic, what we might call philosophical underpinnings of shamanism, right. Could you explain a little bit about, you know, what's the shamanic view of our place in the world, you know, from varying angles? But yeah, I mean, do you know what I mean by that question?
I believe so. And I think I can speak to that. So the shamanic worldview is animistic, first of all. And of course, it differs depending upon which culture you come from. But we, you know, in general, in shamanism, we see the world as full of spirit, but we see not just spirit in what we would traditionally think of as living beings, as animals. We see spirit in trees. We see it in rivers and rocks and mountains and everywhere we look. And so our place in that really is that we're no different. We are completely interconnected with everything. With everything there is, and everybody is connected with everybody else and everything there is. And really, it's about being in relationship. How do I get into better relationship with nature? How do I get into better relationship with my community, with myself, and with spirit? And so relationship really is the cornerstone of any sort of shamanic work.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, from that is the sort of, I don't know if it's an underlying assumption or presupposition that, you know, in general, many humans have been disconnected from a lot of that. Is that a fair thing to say?
Yeah, I mean, I say that from personal experience. I think the number one reason why clients come to me, and I'll say, you know, what is it that brought you to seek me out to you know, have a session with me or just to talk. And the number one thing I'm hearing from people is I just feel really disconnected. I feel disconnected from my spouse or myself or from spirit or from the world in general. And part of that is trauma. The world, you know, trauma causes dissociation for one. So that's a disconnection from the self. And shamanism is really good with trauma. The shamanic view of trauma is very similar to the modern psychological view of trauma, that it's a fracturing of the self. And that leads a lot of people to feel disconnected. And there's a lot of trauma out there. Even, you know, when people haven't been to war or haven't been through violence, there's even, you know, secondhand trauma from experiencing the things in the world that can happen. And so, you know, it is, I sort of say that trauma is kind of a silent pandemic, right? It's everywhere. It's in most people. But we mostly don't know about it, and we mostly don't talk about it.
Yeah. And I think that there's a good distinction that someone made between, you know, they call it big T trauma and small T trauma.
Right.
Where typically we think of trauma as big T, capital T trauma, of these like intense adverse experiences that happen, you know, once off or perhaps repetitively, as opposed to the small T traumas, which are like everyday challenges and things that kind of grow and cause, you know, problems later on. And and it certainly very, you know, affects people greatly. And so, you know, you spoke about the sort of the fracturing of the self, right, as both a psychological and a shamanic view. Now, what happens when that happens? You know, what do you mean when you say that the self has been fractured?
Yeah, and so I can, I mean, I'll, I believe that modern psychology and shamans are talking about some of the same exact things, but using different language. So from shamanism, I use language of spirit and soul. And in psychology, they might use depending on the school, they might talk about, you know, developing subpersonalities or dissociation or that sort of thing. So in the shamanic view, we have what's called soul loss. And we view the soul as a part of us, as a spiritual part of us that is can in fact be affected by our life experiences. And the story that I'll use to describe this is sort of like trauma is anything that causes shock to your system, right? So you talked about the little t everyday traumas, right? And I think about just driving, right? Just driving around and almost getting into a car accident and, you know, it scares the heck out of you and your heart's beating. Well, it's a small trauma.
Yeah.
And what can happen from a shamanic perspective is that a part of you leaps away to safety. Like, I don't want to experience, this is so horrible, I don't want to experience this. That's where the shock comes in. Now, with a lot of small t trauma, a lot of these minor traumas, frequently that part will just come back. We'll just kind of pull ourselves together and get through it. But when it's larger, that part can be so frightened that it stays lost. And that's where we get this soul loss, or in psychological terms, this sort of fracturing of the personality, of the attention even. So people with PTSD have attention deficit issues along with dissociation, and that is this feeling of being disconnected from the self or disconnected from the world. And those are the symptoms that we see with trauma. But in shamanism, we explain it a little differently than they do in modern psychology, but I honestly think it's a case of people yeah. using different language to describe the same process.
Yeah, I mean, that would make sense, right? It's terminological differences. We're all
right.
sort of made up in similar ways, and how we describe
yeah.
it is subject to interpretation and terminological differences. And so, you know, so the process of healing trauma is very complicated, obviously. And it, as far as I'm aware, there doesn't appear to be a one-size fits all solution for everyone, which is unfortunate, but that's how it is, right? And so when we have these parts of ourselves that are disconnected, right, so the soul loss or the you know, sort of a psychological disconnect, and it sort of gets stored in the unconscious, or however you want to sort of phrase mm-hmm. it psychologically, you know, there's a good literature in psychology on how that affects your conscious mind in sort of subtle ways, and you don't even necessarily know that it's happening while it's happening, right? And it leads to all sorts of things like avoidance and anxiety and depression and a whole lot of fun things. And so, you know, there's a complex psychological process of, you know, reintegration and exploration in order to sort of facilitate healing. What's the shamanic version of that?
Right. Right. So, so the process in shamanism is called soul retrieval, and mm-hmm. it's a ritual or ceremony that we do to heal that fractured part. And, you know, it is about bringing that part back and reintroducing it to the person. But then there's usually a period of 5 to 6 weeks, and there might be work that the person has to do to help reintegrate that part. Mm-hmm. And there might be more parts missing that have to be healed over time. Certainly, people with complex PTSD, for example, might have a lot of traumatic events stacked over time to heal. And so that process is really working with the person. This ceremony, soul retrieval, exists all over the world in indigenous cultures. In some tribal cultures, they would, like, immediately, if you experienced a trauma, bring you back and then surround you with loved ones and do this ceremony with you. in order to try to take care of solas kind of before it happens and before you realize, you know, 20 or 40 years down the road that you've been dealing with trauma. We don't do that. We don't do that in Western culture. We don't have, I mean, for one, we're not a tribal society that we all live, you know, in you know, village kind of situations where that is the case. And we don't have, you know, we don't have medicine people in general around us. So we have to seek out, we have to seek out shamanic people and have sessions with them, which is, you know, a modern, modern adaptation. You know, it's the way that I work with people. People, you know, seek me out and we schedule sessions. But in an indigenous culture, you would just be, you know, hustled into the shaman's tent or hut or wherever they were living. And you would be surrounded by people in the tribe who loved you. And that, and it's almost like a welcome home ceremony to help reintegrate that part. And integration happens much quicker in those circumstances because the part hasn't been lost for very long. But you're also getting this social support that is, I think, really missing as well in something I always ask clients about, what's your social support structure like? Because that is a really, really important thing in any kind of healing, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, it's an amazing practice, you know, that, that they do with, you know, huge amounts of compassion and empathy to towards people who have, you know, gone through something terrible. And I agree, it's certainly something that could benefit a huge amount of people were they to have access to that. But living in, you know, the sort of cities that we live in now with millions of people, it's much more of a problematic thing. And I guess particularly for people who grow up where their caregivers and support network are, you know, contributing to the problem. It's, and listen, I mean, I don't know, presumably sometimes that happened in the, you know, native cultures as well, but maybe to a lesser extent, or I don't know, it's complicated. But the idea behind it, I get what you're saying. It's brilliant, I think. And it's certainly something that, you know, we could use more of. And it's interesting because a lot of the time, you know, like trauma and things like that lead to, you know, like depressive symptoms. And one of the things that happens when people get depression is they isolate, right?
Right.
And they withdraw from their social supports or from life in general, which feels like, I mean, it's a defense or a safety mechanism, and it feels safe to do that. And yet it's the exact opposite of really what's needed, which is that, you know, real social support from loved ones and other, or people who care, at least. It doesn't have to be loved ones per se, right? It could be a healer of sort.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one of the, it is an interesting thing to me that one of the symptoms of depression is that isolation. And, you know, one sort of theory about that is that it is, it's what we call sick behavior, right? So when we get the flu, for example, our instinct is to isolate and, you know, not be very active. And so a lot of, besides the physical symptoms of flu, a lot of those things that we do, even some of the physical symptoms mimic, not mimic, they're identical to what happens in depression. Mm-hmm. And with people who have major depressive syndrome or, you know, major depressive disorder, you can draw their blood and they have the same C-reactive proteins in their blood as people who have the flu. Mm. So this mind-body, mind-body-spirit connection is incredibly important. Yeah. And in the and you're absolutely right. In the shamanic view, that extends beyond the individual to the it extends to the family group. It extends to the you know, the tribal group or whatever groups you happen to belong to. And yeah, it's having, you're right in the way that you describe it, that having that genuine, compassionate support, that's the important aspect. You know, support groups are fine, but having people who intimately care about you in a very real way is pretty healing.
Yeah. No, well, I mean, there's a long tradition if you just look at any of the sort of mutual aid societies, right? The sort of Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous. Right. I mean, that's what they're facilitating, right? In a sort of a different context of more like mutual aid, I suppose, by definition. But that's what they do, is that they're all there for each other, right? And they create these little groups or societies that offer, you know, a space of non-judgment and compassion and support to help people. And it's, you know, one of the leading ways that people, you know, find support for their sobriety or whatever it is. And it's great, you know, in terms of what we could do with our modern times, you know.
Right. And it fosters an environment of true empathy, right? Yeah. Where, you know, if I'm in a group who has been through the same things, you know, we can talk about that experientially. You know, I can talk to you, you know, if I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, for example, I can talk to you about alcoholism from a, yeah, I've been there perspective. And that is true empathy. And that's a big part of that connection, to realize that, you know, very different than sympathy. You know, I feel bad for you. Empathy is, you know, the ability to really put yourself in the other person's shoes, mm-hmm. and hold space for them with compassion. And it's extremely healing. And so those you're you know, pointing out those models is spot on.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, in psychotherapeutic training, the main thing that they teach is empathy, right? It's like, well, that's what you're doing. You're not really a problem solver. You're there to be an empathic space to allow people to work through and integrate their various emotional experiences and things like that. I mean, yeah, there's some, you know, interventions and therapeutic aspects of it that are important as well. It's not just silence. That's the foundation, right? And they talk very much about how the therapeutic relationship, which is the relationship between the therapist and the client, is the foundation for change in therapy. You know, the modality itself, whether it's, you know, CBT or psychodynamic or whatever, or humanistic, whatever it is, that the sort of scientific evidence suggests that only accounts for roughly 10% of the transformative power, whereas the therapeutic relationship is almost all of it, right? Which is fascinating that that's how it pans out, given, and it makes sense given that there's what, roughly 500 different types of psychotherapeutic schools of thought, and yet
it's mind-boggling. Yeah,
and yet, you know, they all are working on the same thing with people, right?
Right,
or similar, at least, same in kind. But before I move on, I wanted to touch on this idea of, you know, I was reading up about shamanism and stuff, and you mentioned this idea of empathy coming from a place of lived experience, right? And there's this term called wound resonance that you've used before. And I think it's a very insightful way of explaining, you know, how that comes about, where I've lived through it, so I know at least the kind of thing you're living through, though not your exact experience of it. It's sufficiently close that you can tell that, you know, I know really where you're coming from. I'm not just imagining it. And it's a hugely, you know, impactful thing. What's your sense of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's not a term that I coined. I stole it from somebody, but wound resonance in my experience is very real. Mm-hmm. You know, and my background, you know, I have a traumatic childhood background, and I spent a lot of my time in shamanism working on that, and, you know, have been able to live symptom free for quite a long time. And I think, you know, I can connect with people on a very deep level who have similar experiences. And in the beginning of my practice, when I first started seeing clients, I wasn't even really advertising that, you know, I specialized in trauma or anything like that. But for the first couple of years of my practice, 100% of my clients came to me with trauma. Mm-hmm. That's just how it worked. And the only way I can explain that is they had either through some, we could call it supernatural sense, or from reading things that I have written and the way that I, or heard the way that I speak, there's an unconscious understanding that, here's a person who has had a similar wound to mine, who has done some healing around that. And so this is somebody who can understand where I'm going from, what I'm going through. But also I hope that, you know, having a little bit of my story and seeing how far that I've come a little bit can be hopeful for people. Cause I'm not smarter than anybody. I'm not more talented or more spiritual. I'm not particularly psychic or any of those things. So if I can heal from these things, I really think anybody else can. And it does my heart really good to see people healing from these things. So in a way I can, hopefully act as some kind of, I don't want to say example, like people need to look up to me, but they can look at me as an example of, here's a guy who was, you know, in really bad situation. I mean, it was affecting my physical health. I lost something like 60 pounds in less than 2 months. And whoa. My doctors were like, don't lose any more weight. I'm like, I can't, there's nothing I can do about it.
Yeah.
Right. My adrenals were burned out. I had all kinds of, you know, all of these physical symptoms that for the longest time didn't know where they were coming from. Mm-hmm. And then somebody said, you know, maybe you should look at some therapy. And it just opened the floodgates and things took a real turn for the worse. But yeah, I do think that wound resonance is a real thing. And I do think that it helps me sit in a space of empathy with my clients as well.
Yeah. And it makes sense, right? That people are drawn to people who have gone through similar things that have come out the other side, right? Because we're very, as social creatures, we like to mimic things. And there's very much this prevalence of an idea that, okay, well, if he can do it, maybe I can do it too, right? And the sort of classic example of that is, you know, who was the guy who ran a mile in like under 10 seconds?
Oh, in under 4 minutes.
In under 4 minutes, yeah.
Yeah, I don't remember his name, but like once he did it,
everyone.
You know, nobody had done it. And people were even, there were even articles saying it's impossible. It's physically impossible for human beings to run faster than a 4-minute mile. And then as soon as one person did it, everybody
yeah,
was
like
doing it.
Yeah, like high school students started doing it. Right.
Right.
And it was just
right.
That sense of belief of like, oh, it is possible. Right. So I'm actually going to try for it.
Yeah.
Now, how that first person decided that, you know, but hey, that's some serious determination and foresight because he was right.
Right.
Yeah. So listen, I wanted to talk to you about shamanic journeying, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the experience of that. So maybe, you know, could you give a little bit of an explanation of what that is when you talk about shamanic journeying?
Yeah, absolutely. Journeying is the main practice of shamanism. And almost everything we do through journeying. There are other things, you know, rituals and things that we do, but journeying is the main practice. And it really is what defines, you know, when we use the term shamanism in English, this is what we're talking about. So shamanic journeying has three basic components. The first is an altered state of consciousness. And this altered state turns out to be unique to shamanic journeying. It is similar to somebody who is on magic mushrooms. We have found out recently from EEG research. But it is, in fact, unique. It's unique to meditation or anything else that anybody is doing. There's lots of different ways to alter consciousness. Most people who are doing it are using rhythm. So they're using drumming or rattles or sticks or different instruments in Australia or what have you. But they use a particular rhythm, and people have been doing this for tens of thousands of years, even before we had EEGs. So we altered our state of consciousness. The second component is travel in non-ordinary reality or travel in spirit form and spiritual world. So when we journey, we perceive these different worlds that we can travel to bring back healing or information. And most shamanic cultures recognize at least three worlds. The world we live in is the middle world, and there's an upper and lower world. And I do come from a Judeo-Christian background, so the upper world is not heaven and the lower world is not hell. These are different. They're conceptually different, completely different things.
Yeah.
And the third thing is we always work with helping spirits. And so, you know, people have heard of, you know, like power animals or spirit animals, and all shamans have power animals that they work with, which are animal spirits. And then we might, depending on your culture, you might work with, for example, ancestral spirits or spirits of place. So every culture, almost every culture in the world, and definitely every indigenous culture has little people of some sort. So, you know, leprechauns in Ireland or fairies or elves or gnomes, and every culture has them. And they, you know, when you look at the stories and what they're capable of and what they're supposed to do, every culture seems to have the same descriptions. They're either mischievous or they're hardworking and they help, but don't cross them and this and that and this and that. And these are, you know, we see them as sort of elemental beings or spirit beings that weren't deceased humans. They're just spiritual beings that live in the same space that we do. And the world is, in fact, appears very crowded with spirit when you journey shamanically. Huh. But those are the three basic components of shamanic journeying.
Okay. So now, when in your experience, right, when you go take a shamanic journey, what's the right word? Embark on a journey? I don't know.
I just say when I journey, but okay. I mean, I guess embark or take. Yeah, I don't know. I guess when I journey. Yeah.
So when you journey, right, what's the experience like for you? Like, I mean, it might be hard to describe, but because, you know, we're using language that describes this world for the most part. But, you know,
right.
in your best estimation, you know, what's it like to journey?
Yeah, and I will say that everybody has a little bit of a different experience because we're talking a very subjective reality here, right? So mm-hmm. we're talking about experiencing non-physical reality in a way that is replicated so that we can understand it by our consciousness. So it appears to be physical reality, but it's non-physical. And so everybody's brains are a little bit different in how they interpret that. So for me, it is my, it's very much like The Wizard of Oz, right? Going between, if you remember the movie, The Wizard of Oz, when Dorothy goes to Oz, she starts out in black and white in Kansas. And then when she winds up in Oz, it's this amazing, super bright technicolor reality with all of these beings around her and all that stuff. And that's a little bit what journeying is like for me. I find the saturation of the colors I experience turns up. Things tend to be beings in particular tend to shapeshift. They change shape or depending upon what they're trying to communicate. There's a lot of metaphoric information that comes up as well for me. So I might be journeying on somebody's behalf and see something really strange that makes no sense to me. And then when I come back and say, I saw this and I don't understand it, they're like, oh yeah, you know, that's important to me in this way, kind of thing. So it is a really altered state. When I come back from it, because I've been meditating my whole life. It's very different than coming back from meditation. It actually takes a few, 2 to 3 minutes for me to feel like I'm back in my body and grounded when I get back, because it's a pretty profound shift in consciousness that happens. And other than the sensory information, it is a little difficult to describe in terms that make sense in. And I feel like that's a weird thing to say. Like it's hard to put into words, but some experiences truly are hard to put into words. And then of course, you know, if you're journeying to different worlds, they appear very differently. So the lower world, which you know, you get to by imagining going traveling into the earth is very natural. And it, you know, there's forest and trees and rivers and lakes and streams and stuff, and not very many structures, although there do tend to be structures there. And the upper world does appear a little bit like what we think of from popular, popular media of heaven being like. It's cloudy and misty and a little bit amorphous. So in that respect, depending on where you go, your experience can be very different as well.
And obviously, you know, you go to the different places for different purposes, and, you know, depending on what you're trying to achieve, I suppose. But so in terms of the setup, right, so you're – what's the physical setup of, like, going in – of journeying? You know, are you in your office or whatever with drums or
Yeah, most of the time when I'm journeying for a client, I'm sitting here in my office as I am talking to you, and I prefer to use a drum, and I prefer to drum myself. There are certainly you can find millions of drum tracks and from YouTube to Spotify and whatever that you can use, but something about the physical motion of drumming for myself helps me to reach. You know, that reach the shamanic state more deeply and quicker. So I do. You know, I will sit and drum. In some shamanic cultures, they don't sit. You'll see, particularly if you look at Mongolian. Well, sometimes they do, but if you look at Mongolian shamans, and you can find video on YouTube and things, they dance. Mm. So they get up and they're playing their drum and they're dancing. They're in an alternate reality, but they're dancing through it. So in physical reality, they're dancing, but they're dancing through their journey as well. And dance is another way to induce trance. There are cultures in Africa that dance for, you know, a couple days in a row, you know, without stop, yeah. In order to induce some pretty profound altered states.
Yeah. I mean, you know, tribal dancing has been around since, I don't know, tribes began, let's say.
Right.
Okay. So in terms of, let's say, your experience, right? So you're sitting in your office, you're on the phone with a client, or they're in the room with you, right? And then you decide, okay, I'm going to start my journey. So you start your drumming. Eyes closed, eyes open.
I journey with eyes closed, and most shamanic practitioners, shamanic healers, will either journey with eyes closed, or there is this other there's sort of an apparatus that some people wear called an eye curtain. Which is, and you can find pictures of that if you Google it. You can look up Siberian eye curtain. In many places in the world, they'll wear this sort of fringe over their eyes, which allows them to be kind of in both spaces at the same time. Shamans tend to work in liminal spaces, right, which are the spaces between the worlds, and we have to go back and forth quite a bit. So this eye curtain, and some of them are absolutely beautiful, shamanic headdresses and eye curtains and things like that can be some of the most beautiful tribal artwork you can find. But this does, it's an apparatus, for lack of a better term, a piece of garb that they wear to allow them to be kind of in both worlds at the same time. I tend to journey with eyes closed just because it blocks out distraction. Some people will wear, you know, blindfold or something to block out even light hitting their eyelids. I've never needed that, I tend to do it eyes closed. So when I'm on, and I normally like clients who are remote, normally over Zoom, I like to see people when I'm talking to them. So I just tell them, I'm like, I'm going to close my eyes and you'll see me drumming. And that's, you know, that's all you're going to see me doing at this point. But that's basically it.
And so, you know, the sort of altered state, right? Because you mentioned that you sort of tend to stay in these liminal phases of between worlds, right? So is your experience that you have somehow left this world? So you stop basically all sensory input Or it, do, are you aware of the sensory input, but you're also aware of other things?
Do you know what I mean? Yeah, I mean, it's so it depends on what I'm doing, but it, normally in a journey, I am pretty cut off from the sensory input of the physical world. It's not to say, you know, if my fire alarm went off, it wouldn't shake me out of a journey. I've had UPS delivery driver come and pound on my door while I was in the middle of a journey before and has, you know, startled me back into my body. But it is very much, for me, an experience of stepping out of my body. And so you know, and what it is I'm, the way I like to describe it is like I'm tuning my consciousness, like you tune the radio in your car. So your car has every radio signal generated on this planet and from outside of this planet in it at the same time. But you can only pick up, you know, a range of frequencies. And really your radio, when you tune it, only picks up one frequency at a time. And so I'm essentially, by journeying, by using the drumming or whatever technique I'm using to journey, I'm tuning my consciousness to a different frequency, which is away from my physical body and towards, you know, towards these spiritual realities. So for me, it is definitely experience of stepping out of my body.
Into some other reality. I mean, again, it's hard to put words to these kinds of things. Right.
yeah.
Because I've never had that kind of experience. So I'm just trying to get a sense of what it's like for you right now. Is it an enjoyable experience or is it neutral or does it depend?
Yeah, for me, I like to say that I always, like, even if I'm working on behalf of a client, like, I always get a healing from doing a journey because it is, you know, it has a similar effect to meditation on the person who's doing the journeying, in that you're spooling down your brain and you're stimulating your parasympathetic nervous system. So it is pleasurable to me. It's very pleasurable. And there are particular types of journeys, that are even more so. There's a place called The Void, and it sounds a little scary because seems like there's nothing there. But when you go there, like when I journey there, and when others journey there, you lose complete physical sensation. So it's gone. And that might seem scary, but it's actually incredibly relaxing. You can imagine, like, no aches or pains in your body whatsoever. No anxiety, no depression, no nothing. It's no concerns, no worries. You're just kind of floating, and it's sort of like if you've ever done a sensory deprivation tank, but it's even more relaxing than that to me. So there are, you know, all journeys feel really good to me. There are some that are almost addictive in nature. Like, I really want to go back there. And when you first do the journey to the void, when you're first learning to do that, in the setting, if you're, you know, learning as part of an apprenticeship, for example, my teacher makes you sign a contract that you're going to come back. And because it is very seductive, it feels so good to go there that you, have to promise that you're going to come back. I don't think she's ever had any.
Could you stay there potentially and die?
I don't know what could happen. Theoretically, if your soul leaves your body completely, you die physically. Or you could, you know, one of the risks of not coming back from a journey properly, which is why it's important to have good instruction and how to journey, is potentially you can create soul loss because you can leave parts of yourself behind. And over time, it's the same effect as trauma. You can wind up with depression or dissociative symptoms, you know, that sort of thing. So I would say that's probably the biggest risk. I've never heard of anybody dying from a journey, but I suppose, you know, in an infinite and expanding universe, anything is possible.
Yeah. I mean, it certainly sounds like it could be a thing, you know?
Yeah.
And there's lots of evidence of, you know, animals who think they're about to die that actually just die before anything has actually killed them, right? Which is a very strange phenomenon, but nevertheless, indicative of like some sort of, you know, automatic shutdown method that that we have going for us that is risky to toy with, let's say.
Right. And you hear about Buddhist monks, for example, in Tibet and Nepal, who die consciously, right? They just decide, you know, it's my time, and they sit down and they meditate, and they just pass away in the meditative state. And I don't know what the process is that they go through, but, you know, it does appear that you can, you can have some choice over how you depart.
Mad. I'm thinking of the monks who are just like, you know, it's time. I mean, it's a weird like form of some sort of suicide, but it's not really because we, or maybe it is, but because they're monks, we give it some sort of different level of respect. I don't know. It's complicated.
Yeah, I don't think they view it in a different way than physical suicide, because you obviously you have to have reached a certain level of attain, you know, whatever the attainment is to be able to do that, a certain level of skill anyway, to be able to die consciously like that. And, you know, if you have, I guess it's assumed that, well, you know what's best, you know it's your time, and it isn't just, you're not just seeking a way out because you are, because you're depressed or because, you know, you're suffering, you just, this is your time and you've got things to do in the next life.
Right. It's not a way out of pain. It's a, some sort of ascension rather, you know?
Yeah.
I suppose that's a fair enough distinction. I mean, I've never even heard of that before, so I'm going to definitely look into what that's about.
Yeah. It's a very interesting phenomenon, but yeah.
Yeah. But so, okay. So back to the journey, because it's fascinating to me right now. Does it ever go wrong, or are there like negative experiences that can be had during journey?
You know, so yeah, I mean, it's not 100%, it's not 100% safe. There are things that you can do that can cause problems, like not returning correctly from journeying can lead to soul loss. The middle world, which is the world we live in, is a little tricky because there are suffering spirits here. People might refer to them as ghosts or what have you, but there are stuck spirits, and they sometimes get attracted to spirits that are still living and can tag along as hitchhikers. And I've had my issues with that. My former wife kept saying, "Would you stop bringing people home with you when you come back from these retreats?" Because she would, you know, I'd come back from something and she'd hear, you know, footsteps in her hallway and see people at the foot of the bed and all of those paranormal things. You know, I thought it was funny at the time. You know, she did not, but.
Yeah. No.
So there are, you know, there are.
She did find it funny. Like, oh, you're bringing ghosts back. Great. Hilarious.
Right. cut it out. Yeah.
That's awesome.
So to the point where, there's, you know, one of the people who sort of founded what we call core shamanism, which is used by a lot of modern practitioners, is a guy named Michael Harner, who is an anthropologist, who passed away a couple of years ago. But in his training, he told people not to do middle world journeys because he was so scared of what could happen. I don't find it that scary, and we live in the middle world, and so it's, you know,
scary enough.
Just like being cautious of, you know, when I go outside, not walking out into traffic. You know, you just take similar precautions, and you make sure you're working with helping spirits and have protection in place. And the middle world is not that scary. There are things that, if you're not used to them, appear frightening. If you're not used to like non-human spirits and the way that they can sometimes appear, that might be frightening, because we have experience with movies and TV where these things are, you know, demonic and scary and trying to eat your soul and or whatever. But that has not been my experience with things. I've been doing this for quite a long time. Yeah. It's fairly safe, and there, you know, I would say you would definitely want to learn, you know, my ideal, you know, is to learn from a qualified teacher if you can, one-on-one or as part of a class if you're interested in learning a journey. And you can learn the basics of journeying in like a weekend kind of thing. It's just, you know, to become a practitioner takes a lot more time. There's a lot more to it. But you can learn practice. You can learn the basics of And you can learn the basics of journeying in about a weekend. And if you find, you know, a good teacher is gonna help you stay safe and act like a guide, act like a local guide and steer you away from where you can get your wallet stolen or, you know, steer you away, you know, tell you, I remember, you know, and I've always lived in the US. I remember traveling to London on vacation and, like the instinct to look left when I was crossing the street, like almost did me in so many times. So, but when I was with, other people who lived there, they're like, no, you got to look right. When you cross the street, traffic's coming from the other direction. Yeah. I was like, God, I've been doing this my whole life. It's hard to unlearn it. So having a local guide is really, really helpful in the beginning.
And so my sense is what you're saying is that anyone can do it if you're willing to, right?
I believe so. I think that especially current research shows that our brains seem to be wired for this shamanic state. Like we can produce this state in our brains. So there's an evolutionary history there, or we wouldn't have that. We wouldn't have the structures to be able to do that with our brain. There are some people who have challenges with it. There's kind of two groups of people who have challenges learning how to journey. One group of people are, you know, it's pretty rare, but there are people who are aphantasic, which means they can't make pictures in their head. And so there are ways around that. There are ways of using other senses or using strict intention to journey. They just don't have the pictures. They don't have the visuals that some people get with journeying. And that turns out to not even be necessary, having strong visuals. The other sort of group of people are people who have really severe soul loss might have to have healing done before the part of them that journeys might say, look, there's already a big part of me missing. If I jump away from the body, like there's going to be repercussions for that. There'll be physical repercussions for that. Mm-hmm. And so there might sometimes has to be a healing that takes place before people can learn to journey. But I do believe that I believe that everybody can learn how to journey. Some people need to take a different approach than you would get, you know, than other people. But I do think that everybody has the capacity.
Right. And so this group of, what did you call it? Aphantasic?
Yeah. So it's a condition called aphantasia where people don't make pictures in their head, which seems interesting. So it's a condition where the part of the brain, like the imagination, usually people are aphantasic, don't have visual dreams, and they can't visualize in their head. And it's a disconnection in the brain between the visual center and I believe the prefrontal cortex, so that they are actually making pictures. You wouldn't be able to recognize faces or say like what color your mailbox is if your visual cortex wasn't active. It's just that they can't produce pictures and have it come into the conscious part of their brain. It's fairly rare, and most people who come to me and say, well, I can't make pictures or I don't visualize actually aren't aphantasic. They just don't have really strong visuals. And so they can work on that and train that. People are actually aphantasic. I'm not aware of any sort of thing they can do to get around that. But to journey, you don't have to use your visual senses. You can use other senses. I know someone who in fact is aphantasic, who's a fantastic shamanic practitioner, and she uses her other senses when she journeys. Even smell. Like she can smell really strongly in journeys.
So I mean that would sort of, you know, to me that indicates that sort of imagination, I mean it's a bit of a, you know, easy word, but imagination plays a central role in the journeying experience, right? In terms of what this body is able to produce in consciousness. Because, I mean, obviously, right? Because if there was no body or brain, particularly, well, there's no, you can't be journeying. It doesn't make any sense, right? So I don't mean to try and reduce it to some neurological, you know, thing, but it's interesting to look into which parts of the brain, you know, work in these particular ways and how we can use them and learn to use them to have different kinds of, you know, conscious experiences, right? And so clearly the imagination or that, you know, that visual part has some central role to play, but not, it's not a necessary condition, right? So now it's weird. I mean, it's interesting, someone who journeys without that, I mean, what's that like? Is it just a variety of smells and sounds and textures and feelings and things like that, I guess?
Yeah, I would guess. I mean, I've never had that experience. Yeah. I'm a very visual person. So, when I journey, it's even more visual than my physical experience. You are using your imaginative capacity because you're perceiving things that are formless, mm-hmm. and you like to see things. Your consciousness, your imagination is putting them into a form that you can understand. And so for people who don't visualize, a form they can understand might be, kinesthetic or auditory or olfactory or what have you. I don't know about taste. Nobody's talked about that to me. So you are using your imaginative capacity, but we're using that all the time. So yeah, as I sit here talking to you through the computer, you know, essentially photons coming out of my computer monitor hitting my retina, which is causing some electrical signal in my brain, but I'm experiencing this as a conversation with a human being.
Yeah.
And we're not even in the same country. And, you know, but I'm having this subjective experience of having a conversation with you. But the stimulus that's coming, I'm not physically in the same room with you, and I'm not seeing you. I'm seeing an image of you.
Yeah.
But even if you were standing in front of me, I'm still seeing an image of you. I still need my imagination, my imaginative capacity to be able to create the subjective experience of whatever it is I'm sensing.
Absolutely.
We have sense, right? We have sense organs, but perception happens in consciousness.
Yeah. And that's why there can be, you know, interesting disconnects that happen where you can sense and not have the conscious awareness of it, right? Have you heard of blindsightedness?
No.
It's this interesting phenomenon where some people who have brain damage or a tumor that develops in a particular part of the visual cortex, so their eyes and the eyes work properly, but the brain can't process the information.
Right.
So they perceive the world as black, basically. They feel blind, right? Mm-hmm. But they've done some experiments where they'll put these people in front of a person, let's say, and they'll say, you know, which arm am I raising? And the person will say, I don't know, you know, I can't see anything. And they're like, well, just guess. And so the, you know, researcher will lift up the right arm and then the left and then the left and right, and they do it a few times, and they can get it right with almost 100% accuracy, despite, you know, consciously saying that they can't see.
They can't see it, right.
But statistically, right. It's near impossible to get those kind of accurate results repeatedly with different people, you know, over the same sort of time period, which is weird that that's even a thing, right?
Right?
But it sort of suggests that a lot more is happening than we're consciously aware of. And so our subjective conscious experience is only one aspect of a lot that's going on, which also is intuitively correct. I mean, you don't experience blood flow in your body. It just happens.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And if it doesn't, then you don't have any experience at all, but you don't, it's not part of your conscious awareness, nor are most of the functions of the body, you know, like cellular reproduction, cellular division or whatever, even muscle movements. You don't know how your muscles work. You just know how to use them, but you don't know how the fibers, you know, you don't have a conscious feeling of fibers working together or constricting or any of that kind of stuff.
Right. It would be too slow if we had to, consciously do things like that.
Oh my God, it'd be terrible.
Like, okay, I'm going to tie my, imagine like tying your shoes.
Yeah.
Like the complex motor actions that are involved in tying your shoes would be so difficult if you had to do that consciously. So, you know, when I was a kid, I remember learning how to tie my shoes and doing the whole, you know, the rabbit ear, rabbit runs around the tree and comes up through the whole thing to try to remember it and how challenging that was. But even then, I wasn't consciously trying to flex muscles. It's just impossible to try to do that.
The feeling.
Just having the intention. But it's one of the interesting things I talk about with attention is if you've ever, you know, most of us have had this experience where you've been in a crowded room, say like a restaurant or something, and there's 100 conversations going on around you, and you're not aware of any particular conversation, but somebody walks in and says your name, and instantaneously your brain wakes you up and says, pay attention to this person.
Yeah.
How could it do that if it wasn't paying attention to all the words being spoken in the room? Well, it was. It was just happening on a level, like, we can't consciously hold that much information.
Yeah.
We know it's like 7 plus or minus 2 pieces of information at any given time can we hold in basically short-term memory in our what we might consider RAM, to use a computer metaphor. We can hold very little information, but there's a staggering amount of information that's coming into us at any given point in time from if you think about every nerve ending and they can sense, different ones sense pressure and temperature and body position and, you know, our noses are such amazing chemical sensors. We can't replicate that with technology, not yet anyway.
Yeah.
But we can distinguish a huge variety of chemicals, which is basically what our noses are doing. But we don't do it consciously because it would be too much.
And we have no control over it, which is also interesting.
Right.
I mean, you can sort of control it in the sense of like you can block your nose, but you can't choose not to smell something that's around that can be smelt. And likewise, you can't choose not to feel something that's, you know, poking on your skin or whatever. But that our ability to filter out most of the information obviously makes sense, right? Because otherwise, we wouldn't be able to do anything ever. It would just be a flood of information that couldn't be processed. And just, you know, luckily, our brains weed out like almost all of it, except for a tiny bit. But anyway, yeah. Listen, this has been a fabulous conversation, John. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You have a podcast. It's called Speaking Spirit for people to check out. What else? You know, how can people find you, contact you?
I have everything you can imagine because I come from a technology background, so I even have an app and a YouTube channel and a podcast. You can go to my website, which is maineshaman.com. It's Maine, the state, MaineSHaman.com. And there's links to all of that and social media and my blog. And I produce a lot of content because I really love talking about this stuff. So if people are interested in my content or interested in getting in touch with me, they can check me out there.
Amazing. Well, do it. I'll include all those links in the description, of course. Thank you again. And I look forward to speaking with you again soon.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
All right, take care.